From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
As police started to storm the compound of Slobodan Milosevic, ski mask commandos throwing concussion grenades, supporters of Milosevic began to attack me. They punched me in the face and kicked me. They were angry because they viewed this as orders from Washington to arrest the former leader.
On the ground in Belgrade, Jeremy Scahill reports on the arrest of Slobodan Milosevic. Then, Canadian border officials challenged the entry of a 5-foot-tall genetically engineered tomato, a walking dollar bill, and George W. Bush's alter ego. The cleverly disguised activists, they're on their way to Ottawa to help liberate FTAA documents in advance of the Quebec Summit of the Americas. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As former Yugoslav leader Slobodan Milosevic starts his second day in Belgrade's central jail, his lawyer is seeking to overturn a 30-day detention order against him. At the same time, the U.S. is preparing to deliver its verdict on whether the Yugoslav authorities have done enough for it to release about $50 million in aid for the country. Yugoslav authorities intend to try Milosevic for more than a decade of misrule. Police officials say Milosevic's alleged corruption cost the state close to $100 million and that he would face a maximum 5-year prison term if convicted. However, the United Nations War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague is stepping up pressure to have Milosevic handed over to face prosecution for alleged atrocities in Kosovo in 1999. The Hague insists that Yugoslavia has a binding obligation to surrender Milosevic. The incarceration of the former Yugoslav president comes after a dramatic standoff at his villa in Belgrade ended peacefully, with him being bundled into an official car early Sunday morning. We'll have a report on that story in just a few minutes. In a special operation, Israel has seized at least 5 members of Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat's elite Force 17 bodyguard unit. The special unit is considered to be the best trained force among Yasser Arafat's Palestinian police and is responsible for his personal safety. Undercover Israeli special forces camouflaged with foliage picked up the Force 17 members while they were staffing a checkpoint near the West Bank town of Ramallah. Army helicopters hovered overhead during the operation and nearby tanks provided cover. Meanwhile, an Israeli helicopter today fired 3 rockets at a Palestinian car, killing the driver, a leading activist in the Islamic Jihad group. This according to Palestinian security officials. The driver was identified as Mohammed Abdel Al. In the past 6 months of Israeli-Palestinian fighting, a number of Palestinian activists suspected of involvement in attacks on Israelis have been killed by Israeli helicopters firing rockets at their cars. American diplomats flew today to an island in the South China Sea where a U.S. Navy surveillance plane landed after a collision with a Chinese fighter jet. The U.S. ambassador said it was inexplicable and unacceptable that U.S. officials were unable to contact the 24 crew members more than a day after the accident. The plane landed early Sunday on Hainan Island after a collision that China blamed on the U.S. pilot. American officials insisted the Chinese had no right to enter or examine the sophisticated monitoring aircraft without U.S. permission. A U.S. military spokesperson in Hawaii refused to say whether the crew was supposed to destroy its equipment to keep it from falling into foreign hands. Chinese officials have assured Washington that the crew of the U.S. surveillance plane is safe, but they say the fate of the Chinese plane involved in the mid-air collision is still unknown. Hundreds of foreigners, including asylum seekers and others convicted of no crime, are trapped indefinitely in U.S. jails. More than 800 people from 69 countries have been locked up by the Immigration and Naturalization Service for at least 3 years. This, according to documents the Dallas Morning News obtained under federal open records laws. The numbers are nearly 3 times the total previously acknowledged by the INS. The INS records also show that 361 of the agency's longest-held prisoners include asylum seekers and others who have not been convicted of any crime that requires their detention under immigration law. And U.S. farmers shrugging off the debate over the safety of crop biotechnology are making plans to plant 10% more acres of genetically modified seed this spring than last year. These seeds make farming so much easier that many growers are planting more, although several of their biggest foreign customers and some U.S. food companies wish they wouldn't. Despite assurances from regulators, some consumer and environmental groups say the inventors of genetically modified crops have done little, too little research to prove they're safe for human consumption and for the balance of nature. In this news from Amsterdam, two lesbian brides and six gay grooms became the world's first homosexuals to legally marry yesterday as a landmark Dutch law allowing same-sex matrimony in the Netherlands came into effect. The communal ceremony in Amsterdam's City Hall, decked with rose petals, came as new legislation granted homosexuals the same rights as heterosexuals, including the right to adopt children.
We know what they are, so let Monty Tongue be your guiding star and pick up the gun, learn how to fight all through the day and all through the night till come the day when the last fight's won. I want you to listen, son, because Monty Tongue said change must come through the barrel of a gun.
Mao Zedong said by A3 here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. One day after the arrest of Slobodan Milosevic, the United Nations is stepping up international pressure on Yugoslavia to hand over the former leader to a war crimes tribunal. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan says he's confident that Yugoslavia will cooperate with the tribunal and is urging both sides to start talks on how to proceed. The tribunal has nearly completed new indictments against Milosevic for war crimes in Bosnia and Croatia. The new indictments would augment the arrest warrant issued against Milosevic on charges linked to the massacres of hundreds of ethnic Albanians in Kosovo and the persecution or displacement of 740,000 people during the 1999 Kosovo War. Ending a 26-hour standoff, Milosevic surrendered early yesterday after being assured that he wouldn't immediately be handed over to the war crimes tribunal. Yugoslavia plans to try Milosevic for corruption and abuse of power at home. Milosevic maintained his innocence from behind bars. The Bush administration was scheduled to certify by the end of March that Belgrade was cooperating sufficiently with the Hague War Crimes Tribunal. The certification was required to release $50 million in U.S. aid to Belgrade and to approve loans to Serbia from the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. Bush administration officials say they will decide today. We now go to Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill in Belgrade, who was there for the arrest and was attacked by Milosevic supporters. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy.
Thank you, Amy.
So first, let's begin with the latest news.
Well, as you say, Milosevic is now behind bars. He spent his first night in the Belgrade Central Prison last night, where he was interrogated for 2 hours by a magistrate who was detailing the charges to him. He is being charged, as you said, with corruption and embezzlement of state funds. Slobodan Milosevic has pled not guilty to those charges. Just a few moments before we went on the air, a senior advisor of Yugoslav President Vojislav Koštunica said that they are also now considering adding charges to the docket against Milosevic that would include the charge of political assassinations. This charge would stem from what was viewed as an attempted assassination of opposition leader Vuk Drašković more than a year ago, where Vuk Drašković claims that a car accident in which a number of his top aides were killed was the work of Milosevic's henchmen. These charges could also stem from the assassination of journalist Slavko Čeruvija, who was killed shortly after the NATO bombing began. Čeruvija was known to have very close contacts with the state security apparatus and oftentimes Times broke stories about state security, which was very close to Milosevic. He was gunned down in April, shortly after the NATO bombing began. Just moments ago as well, the Interior Minister, Dusan Mihailovic, held a press conference here in Belgrade in which they displayed for reporters the weapons that they claimed to have seized during the raid on Milosevic's compound. These weapons included two armored personnel carriers, three submachine guns, one rocket-propelled grenade launcher, 30 grenades for those launchers, as well as two boxes of hand grenades and more than 20 pistols. Arrested along with Milosevic was also Sinisa Vucinic, who was the head, one of the top officials in Mira Markovic, the wife of Slobodan Milosevic's party. Vucinic was reported to have been manning two machine guns inside the compound when the ski-masked special police officers stormed it in the early hours of Saturday, Belgrade time. As well as Vucinic, three others were arrested for armed resistance to the attempted arrest of Milosevic. So the latest is that Milosevic has pled not guilty. They may tack on more charges of political assassination. And also, they just revealed this large cache of weapons that they claim to have found in the compound of Milosevic.
Now let's start from the beginning of the weekend's events, Jeremy. How was it first learned? How were people alerted to the fact that the Yugoslav forces or police were moving in on the villa of Milosevic?
Well, I was actually sitting in my apartment in Belgrade watching a session of the Serbian parliament that was being broadcast live on TV. This was around 6:45 Belgrade time. Shortly after 7, Branislav Ivković, one of the leaders of Milosevic's Socialist Party, he's the head of the parliamentary group in the parliament, went to the podium in an extraordinary move, and he announced that ski-masked commandos from the Serbian Special Police were en route to Milosevic's house in black jeeps with bulletproof tinted windows. He said six such jeeps were headed toward the house, as well as an ambulance. As Ivković spoke, he called on all citizens of Serbia to come to Milosevic's house to defend the former president. So I immediately went out to the compound, which is in a well-off suburb in Belgrade called Dedinje. And as I got there, there were about 100 what they call themselves patriots congregating at his front gates, at the gates of Slobodan Milosevic's house. They were chanting, "We won't give you up, Slobo." They were saying that this is a NATO plot, that Zoran Djindjic, the Serbian prime minister, who has just returned from Washington, that he had gotten his marching orders from the government in the United States to have Milosevic arrested by the 31st of March, which was a deadline set by the United States Congress and subject to verification by George Bush, the U.S. president. That Serbia was cooperating with the Hague Tribunal. Demanded by Washington was first and foremost that they arrest Slobodan Milosevic, among other things. And so people at the compound on that evening believed very much that this was Washington ordering the government here to arrest Slobodan Milosevic, and they were going to do everything they could to prevent that. So at the front gates of his compound in front of his house, there were 100 of these people. Many of them were working people, older people, pensioners who are loyal to Milosevic. Around the back entrance, some 200 to 300 additional supporters poured in. And here, Amy, the atmosphere was markedly different, as this was the location that many people believed would become the epicenter of any possible attempts to apprehend Milosevic. Most of the people at the front gates, as I said, were older people, but those at the back included younger men in leather coats and ski jackets, many of them with bulges concealing weapons in their jackets. The atmosphere at this place was extremely tense, and there was a talk of a showdown with the Serbian police that could end in bloodshed. As a matter of fact, one of the men who was armed told me that the police have become traitors and servants of Washington, and told me that he would die before he would allow them to take what he called his leader. Well, a Serbian police wagon pulled up carrying regular police officers, not special police officers, at about 11 p.m., and the people congregating at the back to defend Milosevic began to form a blockade. The police got out of the vehicle. They talked for a bit with Milosevic's supporters. They made no attempts to break past the cordon, and eventually they turned back, and people erupted into cheers and applause and chanting about Slobodan Milosevic, just a sustained chant of Sloba, Sloba, Sloba. And then Branislav Ivković, the head of SPS in the parliament who had made the announcement, emerged from Milosevic's compound, and he said he had met Milosevic and said Milosevic had thanked all of them for coming to defend him. I interviewed Mr. Ivković at the time. He said he took it as a serious attempt to arrest the former Yugoslav leader and said that his people would stay there all night because they felt that it was not over. Well, at about midnight, many of us journalists who were gathered there began to receive phone calls from some of our contacts within the Serbian police, and they told us that Milosevic had already been arrested earlier in the day and that he was going to be brought to the Palace of Justice in downtown Belgrade. So we all made our way down to that Palace of Justice, and we witnessed four police jeeps pulling into the compound shortly after midnight. The first two jeeps you could see in, they did not have tinted windows, and they had men in leather jackets covering their faces. The next two jeeps had tinted windows, and it was reported that Milosevic and perhaps his wife Mira Markovic were being transported in those jeeps. Many people began declaring Milosevic arrested at that point. In fact, some European papers who had to go to press actually reported that he had been arrested. Well, I received a call on my mobile phone from Branislav Ivković, the Socialist Party leader, and he told me, quote, "You can believe me now or you can believe me tomorrow when you see this was all a lie. You should come back to the house because this is far from over." Indeed, the former president, Milosevic, did emerge from his villa on Užička Street in Dedinje and greeted his supporters shortly after I received that phone call. He told the Belgrade radio station B92, quote, "I'm not afraid. I expect this story to end in a just manner and for the benefit of our people." And then he added to Radio B92, "I'm just drinking coffee with my comrades and I'm very well. In front of my house, many have gathered who have our people and our national dignity at heart. We are very proud." Well, I soon returned to that compound and joined other journalists there, and at this point the crowd began to swell, the crowd of supporters of Slobodan Milosevic. What we understand was happening during that time is that an apparent conflict between the Serbian police and the Federal Yugoslav Army was emerging. Apparently and reportedly, the head of the Yugoslav Army unit assigned to guard Milosevic's house. First of all, this is standard. It must be said that the army provides protection to former heads of state and to state property, which Milosevic lives in. But apparently, the head of the army unit that was assigned to guard that location had handed the keys to the main gates to supporters of Milosevic, to his private guard. This accusation was made by Zoran Djindjic, the Serbian prime minister. At about 2 a.m., the crowd was growing angrier and angrier, anticipating an imminent raid. Branislav Ivković and another senior Milosevic aide, Ivica Dačić, emerged from the back gate, and they had a megaphone. They began telling the crowd and the media that the government was spreading lies in an attempt to get people away from the property to make way for the raid. They pointed out that Mr. Milosevic had been on NBC News in America, had been on B92, and said that this was part of the ongoing campaign of lies and defamation by the new government. Well, as Mr. Ivković was finishing speaking with his megaphone, dozens of riot police began to charge the crowd after their police vans sped up. These were police in full riot gear, wielding batons and shields. Fighting erupted between the supporters of Milosevic and the Serbian riot police. The people in the crowd began screaming at the officers, "Are you Serbs or Americans?" They were calling them Ustashi, which was the Nazi sympathizers in Croatia during World War II. And they also chanted Ucheka, Ucheka, which is the Albanian acronym for the Kosovo Liberation Army. They were calling them murderers and traitors, assuming that they were there to arrest Milosevic, which indeed it looked like they were. Well, at this point, during this melee between the supporters of Milosevic and the Serbian riot police, the so-called patriots defending Milosevic turned on me. I was on the phone speaking English to a colleague of mine, explaining to her what was happening at that moment. I was punched directly in my face, which left me with a black eye. As I was sort of stumbling around, another one of Milosevic's supporters kicked me in my side. They were trying to kick me to the ground. I managed to make my way away from them, and three men pursued me. These were younger men, maybe in their 30s. They pursued me as I tried to get away. One of them stepped in front of me and pulled up his jacket to reveal a pistol. It was a terrifying moment because at this point gunshots had begun to break out and we could hear concussion grenades going off. I was able to get to safety only after some local Serbian journalists who knew me managed to surround me and intervene on my behalf, and eventually the armed men left me. Well, at about 2:30 a.m., The riot squad, the riot police, Serbian riot police, managed to clear the supporters of Milosevic off to a side of the house, and they cleared a space in front of the gate, which allowed their vehicles to move closer. The black jeeps that I had described before that Branislav Ivkovic said were on their way to the house earlier in the evening then sped up the road to Milosevic's compound, made their way to the front gates, and out of those jumped ski-masked commandos who were units of the Serbian Special Police. Actually, these were some of the elite special anti-terrorist units that had actually fought for Mr. Milosevic in Kosovo. These men came out all wielding automatic machine guns. They began lobbing concussion grenades over the 10-foot-high gates to the compound. They then began scaling the walls, and massive gunfire broke out from behind the compound. There was also shooting outside where we were. All of us hit the deck. We began to run into the nearby woods that border Mr. Milosevic's house. All of us, journalists, onlookers, as well as regular Serbian police, were hiding behind trees and cars as a 10-minute gun battle ensued. Within 15 minutes, two police officers were taken away in ambulances who had been injured. One journalist was also wounded by shrapnel, and one of Milosevic's defenders was also shot in the arm and taken away.
Jeremy, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll hear the rest of what happened as Milosevic was then arrested and find out what's at stake, what's happening with the Bush administration today, the pressure on the Serbian government to arrest Milosevic, holding back money, both USAID as well as IMF and World Bank funding. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill on the line from Belgrade. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we go back to Jeremy Scahill in Belgrade, Democracy Now! Correspondent. Jeremy, you're at the point where the raid is happening at Milosevic's villa in Belgrade.
Yes, as the special commandos moved into the complex, as I said, a gunfight was breaking out. What happened after that was they apparently failed to make their way into the compound, and so this standoff ensued and remained as such all through then the next day and on into the morning. All of us were cleared to within 500 yards of the house, so we were quite some distance from it. What happened was that negotiations were going on with Milosevic. Reportedly at 1:50 a.m. Belgrade time on Sunday, he was given a written guarantee of safety and financial security for his family. When he was handed the arrest warrant, he reportedly remarked, "This is funny," and then went into the vehicle and was taken away. And that brings us up to where we are at this moment.
Jeremy, let's talk about the Bush administration under an act of Congress having to certify by the end of March, which was this past weekend, that Belgrade authorities are cooperating sufficiently with the Hague Tribunal on War Crimes in the former Yugoslavia, human rights issues, and the Dayton Agreement. Otherwise, $50 million from the U.S. would be withheld, and then IMF and World Bank money as well.
That's
why
right.
Well, this all took place this weekend.
We were able, Democracy Now!, we were able to obtain the three-page letter that was delivered by the U.S. Embassy in Belgrade to Yugoslav President Vojislav Koštunica and the Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic last month. And this is the letter that lays out all of the conditions to continue to receive U.S. aid, as well as to get Washington support for IMF loans, which Washington has vowed to block if the Serbian authorities do not cooperate to their liking with the Hague Tribunal. And in this letter that we at Democracy Now! Have obtained, the U.S. government says, quote, that the they should draft a law on cooperation with The Hague that, quote, must not assert that the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia or Serbian courts have superior authority over The Hague. The letter continues, quote, the law should regulate only the procedures for cooperation, which must not be subject to executive or political approval or intervention. What this means is that the United States is advocating that the law eliminate President Koštunica from the process. Koštunica has been an avid opponent of the Hague Tribunal. He's called it anti-Serb and a private court for American interest. If the new Serbian authorities, under the control of Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic, pass such a law, it means that the path would be cleared for extradition to The Hague, eliminating President Koštunica from the process. This is the United States directly injecting itself once again into Yugoslav politics, and really this is remarks that people here interpret as, you're not a sovereign country. This is going to be an enormous controversy here, as though many people do support the arrest of Milosevic, they are against his handover to The Hague. This is being viewed as blackmail by the United States, forcing the people of Serbia to hand over Milosevic in return for much-needed aid. Much of that aid is needed because of the NATO bombing, billions of dollars in damage done to this country because of NATO's bombing.
And so today, the Bush administration will make its decision. What about the power of Koštunica right now as president versus the prime minister?
Koštunica is becoming less and less powerful every day. Power is very much being consolidated by Zoran Djindjic on the Serbian Republican level. He's in complete control of the Serbian police, and many within the coalition that overthrew Milosevic are more loyal to Djindjic than they are to Koštunica. Koštunica is going to have a very uphill battle in fighting Milosevic's extradition. This is being viewed as a quisling government right now by many in Belgrade, run by Zoran Djindjic. Koštunica, who's much more popular than Djindjic or any other politician in the country right now, is being eliminated from the process. Amy, as we wrap up, I just wanted to express my solidarity with all of those struggling for justice and democracy at Pacifica, and to express my support for those banned and fired at WBAI in New York. I wish Juan Gonzalez and the rest of the people struggling against Pacifica all the success, and I'm in solidarity with all of you here from Belgrade.
Well, Jeremy, thanks for being with us from Belgrade with that report on the Milosevic arrest. Again, now Milosevic in his second day in jail in Yugoslavia, in Belgrade. And we'll see what happens ultimately, whether he is turned over to a war crimes tribunal. Jeremy Scahill reporting to us from Belgrade. You're listening to Democracy Now! As we move now to protests that have been taking place over the weekend, citizens from Ottawa to San Francisco are attempting to liberate the free trade area of the Americas negotiating documents, which governments have made available to corporations, but not to the public. The U.S. government has been negotiating the FTAA with selected corporations and 34 countries of the Americas since 1994, but has never allowed citizens to see the documents. Even politicians have objected to the secrecy of the proceedings. Over 60 members of the U.S. House of Representatives issued a letter to the Bush administration demanding the release of the text. The FTAA would expand NAFTA to the entire Western Hemisphere, creating the largest free market zone in the world. It would affect 650 million people and an estimated $9 trillion in capital, and is expected to expand the scope of NAFTA's free trade agenda to cover the service sector. Activists in Ottawa held a forum on Parliament Hill yesterday demanding the release of the documents. Today, the activists are attempting to shut down the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade building where the documents are held. They're also planning to search the offices of the Canadian Trade Minister. Meanwhile, San Francisco activists have organized parallel events with a march and teach-in yesterday and an action today at the Bank of America World Headquarters. The Bank of America is one of the institutions granted access to the FTAA documents. We go right now to Catherine Lulley, a trade unionist and activist with the Ottawa Convergence opposing the free trade area of the Americas. Welcome to Democracy Now, Catherine. Can you tell us what's happening where you are right now?
Right now I'm standing on Sussex Drive in front of the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade. We're doing a human blockade, walking linked arm in arm around to the back of the building. We decided we would look in the back of the building first to see if the document is there. Afterwards, if that goes off well, we will be coming back, doing a human chain surrounding the building, and then people will start entering the building two by two, seeking entry to get the document.
How many people are there?
I'm going to say between 350 and 400. We have, let me just tell you, we have here a citizen's search warrant. It's a document that our members of our affinity groups will go to the barricades and read. And I'm just going to, if you'll just allow me, read to you two small sections of it, because this is what the police will be hearing in minutes.
Go ahead.
Okay. In the name of democracy and of the fundamental right of all Canadian citizens to know what our government is negotiating on our behalf, we are here to demand that we be provided with a complete version of the drafts of the Free Trade Area of the Americas. We know that this draft text exists, that it is located inside this building, Housing Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade. Some 6 months ago, we demanded that the Canadian Minister of International Trade, Pierre Pettigrew, publish the text of the Free Trade Area of the Americas so that we could exercise our right to debate the proposed agreement before it would be adopted. The minister knew fully well that if he refused to provide us with the draft text, our recourse would be a nonviolent civil disobedience action. He has refused. In a democracy, the right to know is a fundamental one. By the virtue of the powers conferred to us by more than 19,000 citizens, as well as hundreds of organizations who support our reasonable and legitimate demand, we ask that you, police officers, perform your duty and assist us in achieving the text that should rightfully be accessible to us. Do not become accomplices of the secrecy and manipulations of this government. If you refuse to seek and retrieve the Free Trade Area of the Americas draft text on our behalf, we will have no option but to attempt to retrieve them ourselves. My name is Catherine Lulley, and I am here to exercise my rights as a citizen. Please let me pass. So within minutes, two by two, we'll be reading this.
How many police are there right now, Catherine?
Approximately 500.
And there are about 400 protesters?
It's just a tad excessive on the police part, don't you think?
Well, Carrie Pither is in Ottawa, and she is an organizer of the Convergence Against the FTAA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas. Can you tell us what happened yesterday, Carrie?
Yeah, actually what we did is we kind of took over our parliament building. We went in and we organized what we call the People's Parliament, exposing the FTAA. We started with a teach-in about the implications of the proposed agreement, and we felt that was really important because there's been a ton of coverage of the protests themselves and lots of attempts to try and find out what's wrong with protesters, but not a lot of coverage and analysis of what we're actually protesting and what's wrong with the Free Trade Area of the Americas agreement that's been proposed. And so we started with that teach-in. We had a fantastic panel of resource people, but a lot of everyday people participating, asking questions that your neighbor, my neighbor would ask. We really worked hard to ensure that it was a diverse.
And what was the main point? What was the main point raised about the FTAA? All of these protests leading to the big summit of the Americas taking place the 17th, 18th, 19th of April.
With the teach-in, the main point was to talk about why we're protesting in the first place, the fact that this is a fundamentally undemocratic process leading to what is being proposed, the FTA itself being very undemocratic itself, and to talk again about the secrecy surrounding that. And then we went into a training session in the afternoon, which was incredibly eye-opening, especially for the security who were working on the Hill, on Parliament Hill. It was a training in nonviolent civil disobedience with George Lakey, actually, from the United States, who came in to do some training along with some other trainers. And it was quite incredible. A lot of people who would not normally go to protests and who are thinking about joining protests had training in how to peacefully assert their democratic right to protest and to keep things peaceful. It was quite incredible. I mean, we made history. We were doing civil disobedience training in the Houses of Parliament.
Well, if we
right
can...
Right in the Parliamentary Committee room.
Well, if we can, we're going to keep you both on, Catherine Lulley and Kerry Pither, who are in Ottawa right now, as they are demanding that the Canadian government turn over the document of the FTAA, Fair Trade Area of the Americas.
If I can just say, Amy, that right now it's just the most beautiful sight. There's a human chain all the way around the Department of Foreign Affairs, and I'm just getting a long shot of it right now, and it's just quite incredible. I mean, hundreds of people just holding hands, circling the whole building, and it's pretty amazing.
Again, Kerry Pither and Catherine Lulley speaking to us outside the offices of the Canadian Trade Minister in the Department of Foreign Affairs in the International Trade Building. On the line also with us from San Francisco is David Solnit, a member of the Fogtown Action Avengers, a cluster of six local affinity groups in San Francisco, a street theater activist with Arden Revolution. And joining us in the studio is Cindy Rawson from New York City Coalition to Stop the FTAA. In fact, she was turned back from the Canadian border yesterday. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Tell us what happened. What was the scene on the border? Where exactly were you?
About nine of us from New York City attempted to go up to the protests in Ottawa, and we went up through the Champlain border crossing on the New York Canadian border. And because of people's previous experiences of being turned away at the border, we sort of expected and planned to have action at the border if we were to be turned away. So a few of the activists dressed themselves with activist T-shirts, slogans, buttons, and they went first. And not surprisingly, a number of them were turned away. And then a number of the other activists came up dressed as things we thought would be allowed to enter the country, such as a Monsanto tomato, two U.S. dollar bills, President George W. I. Bush, and they were, some of them were turned away and some of them were allowed in.
Were you dressed as?
I was one of the walking dollar bills.
You were not allowed in?
No, I was surprisingly enough not allowed in. We're hoping the FTA.
A U.S. dollar bill not allowed into Canada?
Not allowed into Canada.
But on what grounds did they turn you back?
They turned me back, basically, they had found on my record a charge from a civil disobedience that in the U.S. is not a criminal charge. Unfortunately, in Canada, they say it's a criminal charge and I would not be allowed into Canada for the next 5 years. The interesting part is they turned a number of activists away who did not have records. And they had said they'd been arrested for protesting, and the Canadian officials had reason to believe that they would commit similar crimes in Canada. There's brings up two issues. One, that protesting itself is not a crime, at least last time any of us checked. And here they were saying that people had been arrested for it. And it brings up the other issue is that no longer are people innocent until proven guilty. They were saying that simply for being arrested for protesting, these people were guilty enough that they would not be allowed into Canada.
Did the Canadian border authorities seem ready for you?
They apparently knew we were coming, which isn't too much of a surprise, but they had a lot of extra guards on hand. There were approximately 20 uniformed officers of Customs, Immigration, and I believe a few other departments, along with the normal staff of the immigration center that we were in.
David Solnit on the line with us from San Francisco has been involved with actions yesterday and today. David Solnit, though, you also were deported, not in this action around the FTAA, but a couple months ago when you were also protesting globalization, attempting to, in Canada.
Yeah, I was speaking at a university panel and leading workshops on making puppets and street theater at the Organization of American States meeting in Windsor, which was furthering the FTAA.
And on what grounds did they arrest you and deport you?
I had been arrested in a nonviolent civil disobedience action 16 years ago, painting tempera paint on a recruiting station against with the names of Nicaraguan Contras killed by U.S. tax dollars.
Nicaraguan Contras?
Nicaraguan citizens killed by Contras, excuse me.
Uh-huh. And now, what is your involvement in the anti-globalization protests around the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, Free Trade Area of the Americas?
am part of a cluster of anarchist and radical affinity groups that are organizing street theater and direct action. And yesterday we had hundreds of people marching through the streets of San Francisco, took over a street in front of Levi Strauss Company, which is one of the corporations that has access to the text, held a street party, performed theater about what the impacts of FDA would be on our community.
We're going to talk when we come back with Lori Wallach about just what this document is that citizens haven't got a chance to read, but corporations have. Lori Wallach, who is one of the leading anti-corporate globalization activists with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. David Solnit with us from San Francisco, member of Art and Revolution, with local affinity groups there called the Fogtown Action Avengers. Cindy Rawson from New York City's Coalition to Stop the FTAA, and in Ottawa, Catherine Lulley and Kerry Pither, who are in the midst of an action taking place outside the Foreign Affairs Department and International Trade Building, where they're demanding the FTA documents be released. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we bring you the latest on the protests around the free trade area of the Americas, the Summit of the Americas that's taking place in Quebec City in just a few weeks, but the actions already taking place from Ottawa to San Francisco to New York and the Canadian border. Before we go to Lori Wallach, Cindy Rawson of the New York City Coalition to Stop the FTA, what about the press presence at your border action, where you dressed as a dollar bill and others dressed as Monsanto tomatoes and George Bush? By the way, you talked about George W. D.W.I. Bush. Can you talk about the significance of that, why you're stressing that?
Well, people have been turned away for charges less severe than the D.W.I. charge that George Bush was actually convicted of. Now, while his charge has been wiped off his record, taken care of courtesy of his father, if that had not happened, he technically, under these rules, would not be allowed into Canada.
But he will be there for the Quebec City Summit of the Americas?
We certainly expect he'll be there.
So what about the border authorities' response to you and the press presence?
Well, the border authorities actually saw that there was enough press coverage there that they held their own press conference once we had all been turned away. And conveniently, some of the Independent Media Center press had gotten this on tape and allowed us to see it afterwards. And they were questioned, the authorities were questioned on why, whether or not protesting was now illegal in Canada. And they said, well, it certainly isn't. Canada's a democracy. However, they said, entering Canada is a privilege and not a right. And it seems that that privilege will continue to be granted to the people that privileges in this society are always granted to. It's the white, middle class, and wealthy capitalist elite.
Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, can you put all of this in context for us and explain more fully what these documents are that the hundreds of protesters who are now standing outside the Canadian Foreign Affairs Department and International Trade Building are demanding be liberated?
Imagine NAFTA on steroids for the entire hemisphere. It is a corporate dream of taking all of NAFTA's most extreme privileges and rights newly created for corporations, all of NAFTA's worst attacks on the environment and human rights and food safety, and bundling it and passing it on to not just the three NAFTA countries, but 31 additional Latin American, Central American, South American, Caribbean countries. One size fits all, where intellectual property trumps everything. Property rights for investors create a whole new set of privileges that don't exist in any of our country's laws. And all of these new corporate rights would get adjudicated out of the sight of the public, i.e., those of us who be living with the results in closed FTAA tribunals. It's literally a 31-country NAFTA expansion.
And explain why it is that the governments have not released the working document. I know that a bipartisan group of members of Congress were pressing President Clinton, now President Bush, to release some of these documents. Apparently, President Clinton did release a few documents summarizing the U.S. negotiating positions before he went out of office, but it certainly fell far short of the expectations of the Congress members.
Yeah, the summaries that were sent out were just public relations spin. They were of no use whatsoever to describing what was in these texts. And what's going on, the reason why these texts are not being released is pretty simple. These are documents that could not pass the Dracula test, which is to say, if these documents saw the sunshine of public scrutiny, they would not fare well. Many people will recall the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, the MAI, and that was, if you will, big brother of NAFTA. That was the idea of having the NAFTA investor benefits and privileges expanded to a set of rich countries, largely. Well, that got put on ice, thank God, after huge international citizen activism. However, this is a clone of the MAI. It is back out of the freezer and walking around this hemisphere. And in fact, in the same way that the MAI got tanked, once parliamentarians, for that matter, the press, the public, saw what was in there, the FTAA is being kept under wraps because it's so extreme. And we know enough about it, even not seeing the texts. Why? Because we've had our governments tell us it's literally based on the texts of NAFTA. When they sat down to negotiate, they would take the text of NAFTA, an agreement whose seven-year record has shown what a disaster its model is, and they would literally say, okay, what do we tweak here? What do we add here? Do we just pluralize things to add more countries, or should we make it more extreme? But they won't give us the real text because it would cause such an outrage.
We just heard David Solnit in San Francisco talk about the action yesterday in front of Levi Strauss, one of the corporations that did get to see the documents. Who of these corporations is seeing them and who is writing them?
Well, it's as outrageous as one could imagine in a bad dream. In the U.S., the official trade advisory system has credentialed 500 corporate trade advisors. Thanks to a series of lawsuits that we did, an enormous amount of lobbying by many, thrown into that mix are 5 environmentalists, 10 labor folks, and 1 consumer group. Otherwise, it's 500 business interests, and it's everything from retailers like Levi's, the big finance companies and credit card companies like American Express, the chemical and biotech companies like Monsanto, the agri-food groups like Cargill, and they all actually not only get to see the text, but they have a special thing called the America's Business Forum, and this is a quasi-official business advisory group in addition to the U.S. system of corporate advisors. And the America's Business Group has business interests from all over the hemisphere who have direct input into what the negotiations should do. And when I mean direct, in fact, while a lot of people are paying attention to Quebec City, the actual ministerial on the FTAA, on NAFTA expansion, happens this week in Buenos Aires on the 6th and the 7th, where I am happy to say I'm going to join 100,000 protesting Argentinians. And at that meeting, actually, the America's Business Forum has an official session with the negotiators where they will hand them, on the 7th, their list of demands.
how does NAFTA give power to corporations? And how does the lawsuit that we've been hearing something about, Monsanto's lawsuit against Percy Schmeiser, the Canadian farmer, fit into that?
Well, there are all kinds of new rights and privileges that NAFTA gives. Probably the two biggest ones are, number one, the intellectual property issues in NAFTAese, which is how the farmer in Canada comes in. Under NAFTA, there is a mandatory requirement that a country who's a member of NAFTA issue patents, i.e. monopoly marketing rights, on a huge list of goods, including things like seeds, life forms, medicines. And many countries do not allow patenting of things like seeds. And in fact, prior to NAFTA, Canada didn't allow monopoly patenting of a lot of pharmaceuticals. They had compulsory licensing to try and keep down the price. Well, NAFTA requires that this whole list of items that NAFTA sets forth must be granted a patent. And once the country grants that patent, it must provide monopoly marketing rights for 20 years for whatever corporation holds the patent. So the farmer in Canada, I mean, this is one of the most outrageous stories ever. The farmer in Canada is getting sued because a farmer near him had a Monsanto-owned genetically modified seed, and the pollen from that seed blew over in the wind into this other farmer's field, which was not planted with Monsanto seeds. Now, you might say, so what? Well, under this monopoly intellectual property rights business that would be expanded to the whole hemisphere under FTAA, in fact, Monsanto owns that seed. So if a farmer were to save the seed and replant it, it is a crime under NAFTA. And in fact, Monsanto gets a licensing fee if you replant your own seed, and or you have to buy new seed from them every year, or under NAFTA, the police are required to come burn down your field. So this farmer is next to the farmer who's got the Monsanto seed. The pollen comes over, and now his plants are cross-pollinated, and they now have the marker genes of the Monsanto-owned seed. And now Monsanto is suing him to make him pay, the farmer who didn't plant their seed, for using their seed because nature put their seed into his seed.
Lori Wallach from Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Speaking of farmers, Lori, Canadian immigration officials have put out an all-points bulletin to try to keep José Bové, the French farmer who gained notoriety for trashing a McDonald's in southern France, from attending the Summit of the Americas in Quebec City as well.
you do generally know something is extremely wrong with an agreement or a topic or a discussion if it's necessary to clamp down the borders of a said democracy to keep out a public speaker, an activist, as if an activist arguing for safe food for our families was the equivalent of Jack the Ripper. The notion that they're going to bolt down the borders to keep out José Bové is more than anything else a sign of how illegitimate the topic underway is, because all he would be doing is draw public attention to what's going on. And as we've seen with the refusal to release the text and our brothers and sisters in Canada trying to grab it, there's a lot of fear, given how extreme that text is, about letting anyone talk about it, see it. And the intellectual property rules, the farm rules I described, that's only the part of it. The other thing that's in there is the infamous investor-to-state global regulatory takings, which translated out of NAFTAese, is a new right for corporations to sue governments, not in government's courts, but in NAFTA tribunals, for cash compensation for any domestic regulation or policy that they believe has indirectly expropriated their investment or had an effect, quote, tantamount thereto. What that literally means and how it's played out is when a government, for instance, passes a zoning law in Mexico saying a toxic waste dump can't be put in a nature preserve, under NAFTA, a corporation now has a new right to sue the Mexican government for gazillions of dollars for cash compensation. You might ask, why? Because under NAFTA, they have a guaranteed right to their expected future profit, and they get to raid the taxpayers of Mexico's pocketbooks to get their cash back for a reasonable, non-discriminatory, untrade-related health regulation.
What does it mean for governments and corporations to try to expand this idea of free trade into the service sector? We were just hearing, by the way, from some union activists in Ottawa who are trying to get these documents released or liberated, as they say.
Well, and this is the third corporate right. This is the notion of commodifying everything. The idea of NAFTA and the expansion of NAFTA to 31 more countries, the idea is to basically turn things we think of as basic rights or social services into a commodity that can be traded. So things like water, education, health care, under NAFTAs, these are all commodities. They have specific numbers and tariff levels and market access rights. They're not seen as something that we as citizens of a country have a right to have. And in fact, under the NAFTA rules and under the proposal of FTAA, there are rules that, for instance, require what is called national treatment, which is to say, if your school district one year ends up having more students who want to take Spanish than you have full-time teachers, so you contract out that one extra class to some educational service provider, because you never know if it's going to happen next year. You can't hire a whole extra teacher for one extra class. You have now privatized foreign language services, and in the future, under national treatment, you are required to bid out your school's foreign language services to a corporation from any of the countries now in NAFTA, the U.S., Canada, Mexico, under FTAA, 34 countries, and your domestic rules about, for instance, your teachers' union or community control of your schools, whatever, there is now a new right by a foreign language service provider to have access to your market, I mean, your kid's school. You get the point.
We've got the point. Lori Wallach, who's with Global Trade Watch. I wanted to go very quickly back to San Francisco to David Solnit to describe the action that's about to take place there.
Yes, I'm surrounded by a number of affinity groups that in about an hour will be having an intense and nonviolent confrontation with corporate headquarters in San Francisco, where we will be searching for the text. And our message will be, we want to look at the text, but we're also very clear that the FTAA and the global economic system of governments behind it are fundamentally undemocratic. So we're very concerned that we not be appeased by being allowed a seat at a fundamentally undemocratic negotiating table, that instead we look to the Zapatistas, the people, the indigenous people in Ecuador, and we hope to organize the rest of civil society who are all being hurt by this text and create parallel institutions that can stand up and eventually replace the fundamentally undemocratic governments and corporations behind this whole process of corporate globalization.
And let's end up with Catherine Lulley, trade unionist and activist with the Ottawa Convergence, opposing the free trade area of the Americas with Canadian Union of Public Employees. What's happening right now in front of the Canadian Department of Foreign Affairs?
Well, the good news is that the DJ has arrived with the food and the beverages. And the bad news is that the police have formed yet another line. So, situation is good. Big sunshine. People are feeling very festive. It's a festival of resistance. And
does it look like that you'll be able to search the offices of the Canadian Trade Minister for the FTAA documents?
If I could describe to you what it looks like here, let me just indicate to you that we have police coming down the aisle right now, forming a second line, and we have police up on the top of the building with snipers, it looks like, at the top of the building, dressed in black. And I'm not sure if they're going to let us in, but I'm going to tell you that we're going to make a real effort. There's four metal barricades here. We know how to roll over them. I'm not sure after that how far they'll let us go.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Catherine Lulley in Ottawa.
Long live democracy, my friends.
And Lori Wallach from Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, David Solnit in San Francisco with Art and Revolution, the Fogtown Action Avengers, as well as Cindy Rawson from New York. The information you can get from websites, Lori Wallach, where can people go? Well, let me put that question to Cindy Rawson from New York City Coalition to Stop the FTAA, a website and phone number.
You can go to www.stopftaa.org or in New York City, call 212-894-3747, extension 4994.
And another website of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, www.citizen.org. And you can get all sorts of contact information from the website of Democracy Now! At webactive.com. com. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams and Terry Allen. Anthony Sloan, our engineer. You can write to us by email at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Special thanks also to Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be right back.